Local News, Culture, and NPR.
From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, a roundup of news from Albany from the New York Public News Network. Lawmakers return from Memorial Day with a tight deadline and a full agenda. With just weeks left in the legislative session, will they get it all done or come back later to finish the job? Speaker Carl Hastie weighs in. New York is changing how it handles severe mental illness. A new law makes it easier to hospitalize individuals involuntarily. A move Governor Kathy Hochul says will ensure more people get the care they need. We'll have the details. And a bold move to rein in corporate power in New York. The 21st Century Antitrust Act. Plus, Rosie Starr with a special report on junior master gardeners. That's coming up. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump will mark this Memorial Day at Arlington National Cemetery. He'll take part in a wreath-laying ceremony and deliver remarks. NPR's Amy Held reports the origins of the federal holiday can be traced back to the Civil War.
Memorial Day became a federal holiday in 1971. Long before that, Americans recognized what was known as Decoration Day, adorning the graves of those who died in service. Today, it's the turn of two Civil War veterans. John and Henry Whedon served in the 39th U.S. Colored Infantry Regiment based in Baltimore. Thought to be cousins, they are buried in a churchyard in Frederick, Maryland. Joe Wilson, also a veteran, says they have long been neglected. He worked with the VA to secure veteran headstones for the men.
The very least we could do is make sure that they have a proper headstone, especially for Memorial Day, that these men are recognized for their sacrifices.
Tens of thousands of black service members in segregated units fought and died in the Civil War. Amy Held, NPR News.
Recovery efforts are continuing in London, Kentucky, where a powerful tornado touched down more than a week ago. Karen Czar of member station WUKY reports 19 people were killed.
Over the weekend, President Donald Trump signed off on Kentucky's request for disaster assistance for six counties impacted by the May 16th storms. Daniel Bernardi, public information officer for FEMA, said the approval paved the way for individual federal disaster assistance, including a one-time payment of $770 from the Serious Needs Assistance Program.
It's for serious needs like food, water, gasoline, baby formula, breastfeeding equipment, that kind of thing.
As of this morning, FEMA disaster recovery centers are open in two of the six counties approved for assistance. For NPR News, I'm Karen Czar in London, Kentucky.
Gas prices are holding steady with a national average of less than $3.20 per gallon. That's significantly cheaper than a year ago. And as NPR's Camila Domonoski reports, it's cheap by historical standards as well.
If you exclude 2020, when the pandemic sent gas prices plunging, and you adjust for inflation, gas hasn't been this cheap for Memorial Day weekend in 20 years. That's according to an analysis from the app Gas Buddy. Normally, gas gets more expensive every spring, but this year, prices just never went up. Analysts say that's driven by dropping crude oil prices, triggered by economic uncertainty and a boost in OPEC's oil production. Meanwhile, EV charging rates are also holding steady, as they usually do. AAA reports a national average of 36 cents a kilowatt hour. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The Senate is expected to take up the multi-trillion-dollar government spending bill after Memorial Day. People with disabilities and rights groups fear proposed cuts to Medicaid and a larger state role in the program could have devastating consequences. NPR's Kristen Wright explains.
Millions of children and adults with disabilities rely on Medicaid for doctor's visits, specialized care, and medications, also long-term care. Katie Neese, CEO of the ARC, says billions in cuts would mean people would lose coverage.
To assume that states can stand up these new administrative procedures swiftly and efficiently just isn't pragmatic.
Advocates say new work requirements would also kick off many who should be exempt. White House Press Secretary Caroline Leavitt insists those requirements target waste, fraud, and abuse.
It should be going to people who physically cannot work.
The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office estimates 8.7 million people could lose Medicaid coverage under the bill. Kristen Wright, NPR News.
Boeing has reached a tentative agreement with the Justice Department to resolve criminal charges stemming from the two fatal crashes of 737 MAX jets. The deal requires the plane maker to pay more than $1.1 billion, including more than $440 million to a victims fund. The crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia killed 346 people in 2018 and 2019. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering social innovators to transform the world. Learn more at skoll.org. And Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. After Memorial Day, New York State lawmakers will just have a few weeks to try to pass their top agenda items of the year. Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie says the session will be extended by a few days to make up for some of the time that was lost in the budget process. But he isn't predicting whether lawmakers will return to Albany later this year to address federal budget cuts. The state budget relies on more than $90 billion in federal funding. From the New York Public News Network, Chantel Destra recaps the New York State budget process and priorities with Assembly Speaker Hastie.
So I want to get your overall thoughts on the final state budget. Were you happy with the final product?
Yeah, it was. As I've been saying, I think it may be the best budget in my 25 years here in the Assembly. I'm not a fan of the process, but the final product was something that checked a lot of boxes. For the people of the state of New York.
What were some of those boxes, would you say?
Middle class tax cut, the child tax credit, free school meals for all children across the state, paying off the unemployment insurance debt, which now allows us, which is like a tax break to small businesses. And it also allows us to, we were, I'd say, 40-something in terms of unemployment benefits in the country. This now, I think, puts us in the top 20 after doing this. So this is just some of the examples of things that I think checked a lot of boxes for people in the state.
So what are you most proud of when it comes to the final product? And how do you think the Assembly played a role in the final product this year?
I'm fine with everything. But I think we played a key role in the unemployment insurance debt being paid off. Also, my role in negotiating with the five city DAs, including Mike McMahon, who's the president of the statewide District Attorney Association. But I'd say we played a role in everything, even if it's something that the governor raised in their executive budget. The legislature, has the right to review, make recommendations, and make changes. And so I'd say, every part of the budget we played a role in.
And as you said, the process can be very difficult every year. It's very extensive. It's been late the past few years. And this year it was about 38 days late, which is the latest state budget in about 15 years. How do you feel about how the process went this year?
Well, I think the Constitution and then the reading of the Constitution by the Court of Appeals about 20 years ago has given outsized leverage to the governor. And let me be very clear, this is not about Kathy Hochul. This is something every governor has played since Pataki, that they feel they have the most leverage in the budget. That's why they attach their policy priorities to the budget. And they also believe the fact that legislators don't get paid during this is like a double leverage between the powers that the Court of Appeals has granted them through Silver versus Pataki and the fact that legislators don't get paid. Even though I can be very clear, not one legislator complained. It's like we're kind of used to it and kind of built in. But I just don't think the process is good for the people of the state of New York. The process is best when the co-equal branches of government are actually co-equal and not the scales being tipped. It's in the governor here and the legislature is here. So it's a frustrating process, but again, the end product worked.
And so if you could make changes to the budget process, is there, you know, a way that you would want to do that? Is, you know, what could you see that could potentially change here that might make it better?
I mean, any changes would have to probably be, I'd say, through the Constitution, or governors just decide not to instill policy in the budget that doesn't have a fiscal with it. You could, but the actual changes will probably have to be done, would have to be done in a constitutional amendment, which is a very difficult undertaking.
And you've said many times you don't like policy in the budget, and there was policy in this year's budget. How did you feel about that being in this year's budget, the final product of some of the policies that came out in the final product?
Well, for us in the Assembly, we believe a budget should just be a fiscal document. But if there's an Article 7 or a policy that has a fiscal note attached to it, by all means, we should look to do it. But just because governors feel they have the most leverage does not mean that that's when policy should be brought up. Governors still have the right to introduce program bills. They have the right to veto bills. But like I said, every governor has used this leverage since going back to Pataki.
How do you think it played a role in this year's budget? Is that what pushed it into overtime?
That not necessarily, because the even the things that the governor had raised in her budget were things that we said, I can't speak for the Senate, but there are things that I, as the speaker, and I knew as a conference, we were okay in handling and dealing with it in terms of the changes to discovery, as in no one wants cases to be dismissed on technicalities or inconsequential things. So we were very clear on that. We were also very clear that we wanted people who, really can't take care of themselves to get the proper attention and help and resources. But then also people, whether they're involuntarily committed or not, that there's resources so that people don't stay in this this cycle. So these are things we all kind of agreed with, but governors like to use the leverage of I'm not doing a budget to kind of push things in their way, but I don't think it was necessarily necessary.
And the final budget product reflected some issues of affordability, but the governor really made a goal at the beginning of this process. But some lawmakers, both Democrats and Republicans, have said they didn't feel that this budget really tackled that issue. I'm wondering, you know, how do you feel about how affordability fit into the final budget product this year?
I think it was a lot of, if people were expecting one huge thing, I mean, there were a lot of very good things. The governor wanted to do a rebate check to refund to people who actually we paid more in sales tax because of the inflation factor on the cost of goods. There's the child tax credit. There's the middle class tax cut. Free school meals. So there are a lot of things that hopefully will put money back in the taxpayers' pockets.
And foundation aid was also a big thing in the budget this year. How do you feel about how that ended up coming together in the final budget product? Is this going to achieve, you know, the positive changes that some education advocates were hoping that it would?
Well, I'd say at least we were using recent data. Before this year, we were using student data and formulas dating back over 20 years ago. So it's it's an updated formula. I'm sure we're going to still incorporate other things that were suggested from the Rockefeller report, and we'll go from there. But I think it was a good start this year.
So you feel good about how it could play out in terms of the schools?
Well, it's more money. It's more money than inflation. So I think every year we try to give as much money to the schools so they can give our kids a first-class education.
And taking a step away from budget for a second, the medical aid and dying bill that passed for the first time in many years, it's been stalled. And how do you think this, you know, came to the floor?
I think the advocates worked at the bill. They talked to members, and so did the bill sponsor. And they put in the hard work that people should put in. You know, oftentimes there's very limited support, and people still come and demand that the legislature passes bills. But I've always said this is a member-driven conference, and then was when there was enough support, we moved the bill forward. But they worked at this for a few years, they just worked, and they got people to commit to saying they would vote for it. And some cases, they actually changed some members' minds. So it was old-fashioned, the old elbow grease that the advocates put in to get the bill passed. And the bill sponsor, similarly, Amy Paulin, who's also chair of the Health Committee, she put in a lot of work as well.
And there's only a few weeks left of legislative session. So walk me through, what are your top priorities for a few weeks?
Well, we lost about a month into the legislative session dealing with the budget. So I've extended, at least on the assembly side, we're going to do 3 more days of session to try to concentrate on passing members' priority bills, a lot of them local. But I wouldn't say there's one huge policy item that's jumping out. So it's really just trying to get to passing the members' bills and trying to make up for time that we lost during the budget.
So will larger bills like the Packaging Reduction Act make it to the floor? I know that that was last minute. It didn't make it in last session.
Well, we conferenced the bill. We're still trying to figure out where we're going to go with that.
Okay. So there might be time, but you might run out of time.
Well, again, it's, it really is up to the members. What happens, we conference the bills. Members speak in favor of the bill. They may speak. They may ask changes in the bill. They may say they're against the bill. And then oftentimes we reach out to members who have not spoken yet. So we're still spanning the entire conference to see where they are.
And so you had mentioned that the session will be extended about 3 days. Are you thinking any longer than that? What are you hoping will come out of extending it 3 days?
Hoping that those 3 days help us make up for, I'd say, maybe the 15 or so session days that we missed. It's just an attempt to give the members a little more time and attention for their bills, because the staff was preoccupied. Our program and policy staff was preoccupied by dealing and negotiating with the budget. And so just trying to give a little more time for the staff and the members and the advocates to kind of give input on the bills.
And how likely is it that you will potentially have to come back for a special session? I know in the final budget there was a provision to allow the governor to make cuts. If there are potentially changes at the federal level, do you think it's likely she'll make those cuts on her own, or that you guys will be called back for a special session?
I think people's interpretation of what we granted the governor. The governor has the ability to suggest cuts, but it would have to be the first $2 billion worth of cuts has to be filled with reserves. So anything above $2 billion in cuts, the governor can make a suggestion, but the legislature has the ability to say yes or say no. But also, I know in working with this governor, she's not just going to drop X amount of cuts on us without any conversation or interaction. So the governor has the ability to suggest cuts. And if we agree, we don't have to do anything. And if we don't like the cuts that the governor suggests, we can pass a resolution to come up with our own that the governor can accept or veto.
So you think it's likely you guys might have to come back, or?
That's more of a question for our 7 Republican members of Congress, that if they do things that make us come back. So that's not a question I can answer. But if the Republican member of the Republican president, Republican Senate, and Republican House of Representatives make devastating cuts to the state of New York, we'll come back and deal with it and remind the people of the state of New York who are the people responsible for bringing us back to that point.
Well, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to sit down with us, Speaker.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on the show.
And we were speaking with Assembly Speaker Carl Hasty.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, a new law that makes it easier to hospitalize individuals involuntarily. It's a move Governor Kathy Hochul says will ensure more people get the care they need. We'll have the details. This is Radio Chatskill.
You know how a toilet works, right? Well, unless you're a plumber, you might know less than you think.
I'm going to ask you to explain to me in detail exactly how it works. And when I do that, something really remarkable happens. People realize they have just about nothing to say.
The Illusion of Knowledge, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR. Today at 1 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. New York has made it easier to involuntarily hospitalize people with severe mental illness as part of the state budget signed at the Capitol earlier this month by Governor Hochul. From the New York Public News Network, J.T. Stone with the Capitol Press Room reports the governor maintains it will help mentally ill individuals get necessary care.
For too long, those who are suffering from mental illness, severe mental illness, they languish on our streets and in our subways. People who pose a risk themselves and others, but also those who are too sick to secure proper health and shelter and food without help. This will allow us to connect people in the throes of severe mental illness with the life-saving care that they need and they deserve.
State law previously allowed people with severe mental illness to be involuntarily hospitalized if two physicians determined they pose a threat to themselves or others. The updated law sets a standard to include people who are deemed unwilling or unable to support their basic needs, including food, shelter, and medical care due to their mental illness. However, opponents of the updated law say it could be misused to involuntarily commit unhoused individuals without mental illness and argue lawmakers should invest more in voluntary community-based mental health services. During a February budget hearing at the Capitol, State Mental Health Commissioner Ann Sullivan told state lawmakers there are nearly 1,400 available inpatient psychiatric beds that can accommodate the expansion, which she said accounted for 15% of the state's 9,200 inpatient psychiatric beds. Citing high-profile violent incidents in New York City's subway system, Hochul and Sullivan argued the new involuntary commitment standard promotes public safety while providing necessary care for people in need.
So what am I talking about here? I'm talking about people who are physically ill, who don't understand their physical illness because of their mental illness. Not going to overwhelm any number of hospital beds. It's not an issue. It's just to make sure that this small group get the compassionate ultimate care they need, and you don't want to leave them at this high risk in the community. That's all. Small group.
Sullivan added that 43 other states have enacted similar standards to involuntarily commit people with severe mental illness who can't support their basic needs. The state budget also commits an additional $16.5 million for counties to implement Kendra's Law, which allows court-ordered outpatient treatment for mentally ill individuals with histories of hospitalization or violent actions. Additionally, the budget allocates $2 million to hire more state staff to oversee these outpatient treatment programs. Alex, a Long Island-based EMT who requested to only use his first name to discuss personal matters, said he was involuntarily committed in 2022 after attempting suicide. Alex, who was diagnosed with depression and PTSD in middle school, said he was forced to stay in a psychiatric ward for a week after being involuntarily hospitalized. He described the experience as dehumanizing because he felt his mental health had largely stabilized following his suicide attempt.
I mean, I had put, I guess, a lot of thought and energy into just doing it the first time, that afterwards I was like, I don't really feel like, honestly, it was, I just don't really feel like doing that again. And I expressed this to them. However, at the time I wasn't as, I guess, composed as I, you know, would be now. So, you know, I might have been a little bit more aggressive with them. I never like, threatened anyone, never threatened myself again, or anything like that, but I definitely was a bit agitated. And I probably could have gone about it a little bit better had I, you know, been a little bit more in control of myself.
Although Alex enjoyed certain aspects of living in the ward, including communal activities like painting and lunch, he said the experience did nothing to improve his mental health after being discharged.
So they put me on two different medications, which ended up not working out for me at all. I ended up going back on the exact same medication I started on. In terms of my providers, I kept my therapist, kept the same psychiatrist and therapist that I had prior to. In terms of home environment, I didn't change anything. Nothing of note came out of it.
Alex is part of a coalition of mental health and housing rights advocates who oppose the expansion and argue the state should instead invest more in voluntary community-based mental health services. Luke Sakinyi, Vice President of Public Policy at the Alliance for Rights and Recovery, which advocates for people with mental illness, said expanding the use of involuntary commitment could scare people from seeking help.
The folks who are going to be taking people off the street are almost always going to be police officers. And for folks who are already really hesitant to be part of the system, seeing a police officer come to take you off the street involuntarily, it looks and often feels like arrest, you know? And for a lot of folks, that's very traumatizing to them. And it really pushes people away from the system in the first place, rather than towards a system that can provide that support and provide that long-term housing and food security and you know, nutritional support, but also that shelter and clothing for long periods of time.
Harvey Rosenthal, the Alliance's CEO, argued that expanding involuntary mental health services will target people of color, as Black and Hispanic individuals disproportionately receive court-ordered outpatient treatment, according to data released by the state. Studies have shown white individuals have an easier time accessing health care than people of color, largely due to the cost of care. However, Rosenthal called the governor a historic leader for her $1 billion multi-year investment in the state's mental health care system since taking office, including funding for more housing units designed for people with mental illness. The new state budget includes nearly $200 million for mental health services, with a majority of funds going toward 100 new inpatient psychiatric beds in New York City for individuals who have been charged with crimes. The budget also funds voluntary programs championed by mental health advocates, including community support clubhouses, peer-led intensive and sustained engagement teams that support people throughout their recovery journey, and a new program to help hospitalized individuals transition back into society. Additionally, the budget includes $8 million to create unarmed response teams across the state to address crises involving mental illness or substance abuse. This comes amid calls for state lawmakers to pass Daniel's Law, which was named after a man who died in Rochester police custody during a mental health crisis. Assembly Mental Health Committee Chair Joanne Simon, a Brooklyn Democrat, said she worries the new involuntary commitment standard will lead to unhoused individuals being falsely accused of crimes or being mentally ill.
People with disabilities with mental illness are 11 times more likely to be victims than perpetrators. And so we need as a society to get away from this criminalization of homelessness and mental illness.
More than 30 mayors and town supervisors across the state wrote a letter in March urging state lawmakers to codify the expansion. Among the officials was Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan, who said the Albany Medical Center Hospital makes the city a focal point for people experiencing mental health issues.
When they are not able to be placed in a bed there because they refuse, they are put right back out onto the sidewalk. They're not returned to their home. They are oftentimes placed out on the sidewalk in the city of Albany, in distress, in need of care. And so we are very disproportionately impacted by what is a national crisis.
For the New York Public News Network, I'm JT Stone.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, the 21st Century Antitrust Act. This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner. On the next Freakonomics Radio, we kick off a special series about failure.
One big reason we don't learn enough from failures is that we don't share them systematically enough.
We'll hear about failed relationships, failures of the imagination, failures of determination, and failures that cut deep.
I think that was my tipping point where I just went, I'm done. And it broke me.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio, Tuesday at 1 p.m. on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. For years, state lawmakers have been pushing to regulate monopolies in New York. If enacted, the 21st Century Antitrust Act would update the state's laws to tackle monopolies, and the state would crack down on certain business entities, such as big tech companies, and make it harder for them to control the marketplace. Supporters say the legislation is long overdue. They're hopeful that support from the National Teamsters, as well as the bill's introduction in the Assembly Chamber, will finally give it the push over the legislative finish line. But critics, including the Business Council of New York State, argue that if enacted, it would actually cost the state thousands of jobs and negatively impact the economy. From the New York Public News Network, Chantal Destra speaks to State Senate Deputy Majority Leader Michael Giannaris about the 21st Century Antitrust Act.
Thank you so much for joining us here today, Leader.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you've been pushing for legislation known as the 21st Century Antitrust Act, which would essentially regulate monopolies in the state. Can you tell us about this legislation and why it is important for New Yorkers?
Sure. In theory, monopolies are already regulated. The problem is we haven't updated our laws in 100 years. And so these laws were written when, you know, the robber barons and the steel industry were the ones who were dominating the economy. But now we have a completely different landscape. It's more the big tech companies that are in these dominant positions. And the problem is the laws as they exist don't really contemplate or think about how to tackle the problems associated with monopolies in the current environment, the digital environment. Mm-hmm. And so we're endeavoring to strengthen these laws, give them more teeth, change the standard by which they operate, and also allow unilateral conduct to be covered. So under the current laws, you need two entities to come together and conspire to control the market by price fixing or whatever tools they might use. But the problem is currently these big companies are engaging in individual conduct that is affecting the marketplace detrimentally. For example, you might have a company that has a search engine that then controls which results appear higher up on the list. And then they may have a financial interest in the ones that they place higher. And so therefore they are hurting their competition and then ultimately hurting consumers because they are controlling what consumers see and what consumers get to choose from. They can do that unilaterally now. They can do that by themselves, and that behavior is not covered under the current law. So that's just one example of the things we're trying to get at. The bigger problem is that these big tech companies have become incredibly powerful and are controlling not just the marketplace, but oftentimes they attempt to control even government decision-making. And so it's become a very dangerous economic environment for that reason, and we want to strengthen the laws here in New York to deal with that.
Now, of course, this isn't a new measure. It's been introduced in the legislature for the past few years, but with just a few weeks left in the legislative session this year, why are you hopeful that it'll make it past the finish line?
Well, we have passed it in the Senate before, and we're working hard to get our colleagues in the Assembly to join us. This year, the majority leader in the Assembly, Crystal Peoples-Stokes, has introduced it, so that has given us a very powerful supporter and sponsor in the Assembly side. The Teamsters nationally have decided that this is something that is a priority for them, and they are leaning in to try and help get it done in the Assembly. So I'm hopeful more than in previous years that we're at a point where we could pass both houses and get to the governor's desk.
And the Business Council has asserted that this legislation, if enacted, would negatively impact the economy and jobs in the state. Can you tell us your perspective on these concerns by the council?
I say, what a surprise that the entity that represents the big companies that are dominating the markets is against something that would regulate the big companies that are dominating the markets. They are running a seven-figure ad campaign. The Business Council does not have that type of budget. I've known them a long time. So that means to me that these companies that would be directly affected by this level of regulation are investing in stopping this from happening. It means they're scared it's going to happen. I'm glad they're scared it's going to happen because they are actually engaging in behavior that is detrimental to the economy. And they don't want to be stopped. And so what we are doing is helping small businesses, helping medium-sized businesses who are currently being squashed and pushed out of these markets by the big boys to get a foothold and have some regulation that helps them.
And did the budget this year carve out any regulations for monopolies in the state this year?
Well, no, that's why we have the bill. And so it's not a budget issue in the sense that we're spending state dollars to do this. This is about empowering the Attorney General to have greater enforcement authority against what these companies are doing.
And on the budget, what are your biggest takeaways on the budget this year and on the process?
It was not terrific. The governor increasingly has been deciding that the way to achieve our policy goals is to use the budget process. That is not what was intended to be. The budget should be about the state spending its dollars in ways that help the people of the state and investing our resources intelligently. And the reason it was the latest it's been in over a decade is because we spent an inordinate amount of time discussing and negotiating on policies that had absolutely nothing to do with the budget. It's because the governor has greater power during the budget process and under our Constitution, and she's attempting to use that to ram through her policy objectives when that's something that should be handled outside the context of the budget.
And what are the steps to make the process even better?
Well, we have a dilemma here. I mean, it's really about getting using the relationship we have with the governor to keep those discussions separated from the budget. Unfortunately, court decisions over the years have made it clear that governors are allowed to do what she has done, but it is dragging out the budget later than it needs to be, and it is inserting non-budgetary conversations into the budget process. It's not appropriate, but we're trying to grapple with the fact that this is what we're faced with in the meantime. We could have the same level of conversation on all these issues either before the budget process or after it, but unfortunately, she has decided to make it be part of the budget conversation when it doesn't need to be.
And Republican lawmakers and good government groups across the state have called for leaders to not use messages of necessity on budget bills when they are being voted on. They say that the public, the press, and lawmakers deserve to be able to look through the budget bills before they are actually voted on. So I wanted to get your perspective on these concerns, and do you think that the state Senate will ever take up the position of not using messages of necessity on budget bills?
Messages of necessity are a tool provided for under our laws and constitution. They exist for a reason. I would argue when the budget is in fact late and we're anxious to have it be less late, that waiting longer is not beneficial in those circumstances. The Republicans, when they had control of the Senate for the better part of 100 years, used them with regularity, honestly, to a much greater degree than we have been using them since we obtained the majority 6 years ago. And so it's not ideal in terms of good governance, but it's really a byproduct of the fact that the budget was as late as it was. As we just discussed, I wish it wasn't. And if the policy that was non-budgetary was not part of the conversation, it wouldn't have been. But we face what's in front of us and have to deal with it. And I think the school districts and other interested parties throughout the state were anxious for the budget to be concluded.
And year after year, there have been increased calls for transparency on the budget process. This year, those calls were even more pertinent with the looming cuts coming down from Washington, serving as a backdrop on budget negotiations. So I wanted to get your perspective. How transparent do you think the budget process is, and what are the steps that leaders can take to make it even more transparent?
It's not terribly transparent, but we have three parties and we all have to dance together if we want to make it more transparent, which I certainly would be in favor of. We all need to agree to do that. We can't do it unilaterally. We, as a Senate, have done what we could to make the process more open and fair. In fact, our Republican colleagues, the day we passed the budget, were complimentary of our approach in the Senate. We provided the minority with the information ahead of time, so they had ample amount of time to analyze it and comment on it. We had the bills out there as early as we could before we passed it. But we can't engage in an open process if the other parties that we negotiate with aren't also on board with that.
Are you saying that the executive chamber would have to lead the efforts to make it even more transparent?
We'd all have to be part of it. We'd have to empower the conference committees to be more public and engage in additional meetings and have that information be out there for public consumption. It's really a problem we have as it relates to the timing, because if everything is working on the schedule that it should be and the budget's on time, all of these things can happen more easily. But once we're late, there's a scramble to finish in time so that we don't create additional harm to the residents of the state beyond what is already happening by the lateness of the budget. And so all of these issues kind of work together. If we take the policy out of it, if we're dealing with the budget in an open and transparent way ahead of time, and if the budget is on time, that would be the ideal. And so we try and have all of that happen, or as much of it happen as possible. But once the budget's late, once the non-budget policy issues are inserted in there, it forces our hand on a lot of these other issues.
And with just a few weeks left until the end of the legislative session, what would make for a successful end of session for your conference?
Well, we continue to try and tackle the issues that are important for the people of the state. We mentioned my antitrust bill. That's a big priority of mine as we're scrambling to the end here. We have a very compressed time frame. We've got a little less than a month to go now before we adjourn the session entirely. We normally would have almost 3 months of post-budget activity. So once again, the late budget is now impacting all the rest of our work. But we have a number of bills that are priorities from my colleagues. We'll be passing hundreds of bills just in the next 3 or 4 weeks that will tackle the affordability crisis that are affecting so many people, that make people safer in their communities. All of the things we know we have to do, we just have less time to do it. So we'll be working extra hard to get that done.
And we were speaking with State Senate Deputy Majority Leader Mike Gianaris.
A quick break for us, and when we come back, the Western Sullivan Public Library is sowing the seeds of curiosity with its Junior Master Gardener program. This is Radio Chatskill.
Whether Radio Catskill brings a smile to your day, some inspiration, or a greater connection to the Catskills and Northeast PA, we're proud to be here with you. Federal funding, about $1.60 per person annually, helps keep these trusted services strong and accessible to everyone in our community. Learn how you can safeguard local public media stations like ours by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org.
Support comes from the Conover Club Restaurant, located at the intersection of Roscoe, Livingston Manor, Jeffersonville, and Calicoon, featuring seasonal menus crafted with locally sourced ingredients. Hours, reservations, and upcoming events at conoverclub.com.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Western Sullivan Public Library offers a Junior Master Gardener program, part of a larger international youth gardening initiative through the University Cooperative Extension Network. It provides hands-on learning experiences for children to develop an appreciation for gardening and the environment. Farm and Country's Rosie Starr recently visited some of these budding green thumbs.
For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr. On Saturday, May 3rd, about mid-morning, I took a break from my usual routine to visit the Junior Master Gardeners who were meeting at the Western Sullivan Public Library in Narrowsburg, New York. The Tustin Koshechtin branch of the library is hosting a hands-on arts and gardening program for children aged 6 through 12. There are 9 sessions that meet on the first Saturdays from April through December. This one-hour class will be led by Adrian Pichano, and it's entitled Grow, 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 Plant Growth and Development. Let's see what the children are up to on this beautiful spring morning.
Okay, guys, let's put our notebooks down for the moment.
The Junior Master Gardeners wear their hand-decorated lanyard ID cards and begin the sessions with an opening exercise called Crazy Eights. It helps to get their wiggles out.
First thing we need to do is make your body into a star. Just spreading our bodies out, making sure you don't accidentally hit anybody else or anything. Mm-hmm. You can spread your arms and move your legs. We're going to be getting the wiggles out in a little bit. Ready? Right arm. Right arm.
Right arm.
Hold out your right arm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Left arm. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Right arm. Leg. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Left leg. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.
Hi. The assignment for the day is a group activity poster plant identification. Adrian Pichano brings out a tray of seedlings to observe plant identification.
So the first thing we wanted to show you guys and girls is, do you recognize these?
They're our plants!
Yeah. Remember these from last time?
Yeah.
I wanted to show you.
My plants got huge!
These, you can pass them around, just mm-hmm. take a quick look, just to give you all a sense of what we accomplished, right? So these are our little babies, and I have to congratulate you for being plant parents now. Mm-hmm. They're baby kale, baby tomatoes.
You can actually eat these ones.
And then... these are the baby parsley.
Eatable.
Edible.
And edible.
Thank you, thank you.
I can help anytime.
We so appreciate now, that. Now we're official plant parents, all mm-hmm. of us here. Congratulations.
Last month, we had a word of the day, and does anybody remember what the special word was that Ms. A told us about?
Community.
Right. Yeah, that was our word of the day for April, was community. Can anybody tell us a little bit what they remember, what community means?
Like a big area where people could like come in or do something. Like a lot of people in one space.
A lot of people in one space. So I'm hearing a lot about space. Also hearing a lot about people. These are spaces that people share, but communities can also be not just a space, but just when a group of people come together and they decide to self-organize as a community, that community can exist anywhere. Our Junior Master Gardeners group, we're our own community because we came together with this unifying purpose, this one purpose that joins us all together. That's what makes this community. And can people be part of different kinds of communities?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Baseball.
A baseball team. Yeah. That is a perfect example of a community.
Gardening club?
Yeah, gardening club. Exactly.
This is gardening club.
Yeah, so communities can be everything. A lot of different things, and you can be part of many different communities. All right, so our word of the day today is growth. Can I get a volunteer to write that up on the board? Yeah? Come on up. Ooh, can you write it nice and big? Perfect.
Oh, yeah.
Good job.
All of us can be note takers, and please gather a marker to write in your journal. We're going to copy down the word growth because it's the word of the day.
And can you also write down, it's on the next page in your notebook, write down the date. It's May 3rd.
How do we spell May?
M-A-Y.
M-A-Y.
I had a feeling it was Y.
May 3rd. That's today's date.
Okay.
It's good to always write the date in your journal so that you can always refer back to it when you want to know something that you did in the past, right? So what we're going to do next is we're going to take notes on, or we can draw what we think the word growth means to us. Mm-hmm. What do we think it means for us? What do we think it means for plants?
It means like when people grow up, they get taller.
They get taller? So something getting, what's another way to say that? Getting taller?
Big.
What happens when our plants, we started off with our seeds, right? Started off with our seeds. What did they do over the past month?
Grow up into plants.
They started to grow up into plants. They went up.
Started with those tiny little what?
I even started
start with the seeds, right?
We started with the seed, and then it popped up through the soil, and now it's starting to reach towards the sun, reach towards the sky.
Oh, there's another one called huge.
Yeah, when things get huge.
Yep. What do we have in common with plants in terms of what we need to grow?
Water.
Mm-hmm.
Food.
Lincoln.
Sun.
Yeah, we do. Sleep. Okay. You know, the winter time, plants will, you know, after we've harvested everything, they'll go to sleep. And then some plants will pop back up in the springtime. We call those perennial plants, the ones that go to sleep in the winter and then they come up again the next year. So what do plants need? We need water.
Rain!
We need sun. We are not so different from plants, right?
We're kind of like plants.
Yeah. We need a lot of the same things.
Yep. We need water. We need food. Mm-hmm. We need sleep. And we don't really need sunshine.
This plant, believe it or not, started out as a teeny tiny what?
Seed.
Last month when this plant was a teeny tiny seed, it was growing in the soil like we did with our seeds last time. And now it has what?
Grow.
What are these? Roots. And what are the roots growing in?
Dirt.
Dirt or soil. And then what happened? All this stuff above the ground. What are these?
Leaves.
And then the white stuff are petals, which is part of
a flower.
Flower.
Yeah.
Pass this around so you can all feel it, touch it, smell it. It does have an interesting smell. It's called salvia. So every plant basically starts with a seed. Mm-hmm. Every plant sprouts. What's the underground part called? Under the ground is
the roots.
Yeah, roots.
a tree, so it's root.
Yes.
And it's like an apple tree.
Like an apple tree.
It starts from a seed to a sprout to...
We're going to switch over to our next activity, friends.
The class was divided into groups of three and given poster boards and packets with pieces of plant parts, labels, and a glue stick. The assignment is to draw a soil bed. Place roots, stem, flowers, fruits, and leaves, and label the pieces of the plant.
Hey, very nice.
We're gonna glue these in place.
You can put them in different places too,
right?
I think they go like this.
Here we go.
I think they go.
Oh, where do you
can I get a?
I'm Callison Stratton. I am the youth programmer for Western Sullivan Public Library, and along with Adrian Picciano, we are running the Junior Master Gardeners program. Today is our second session. It's our plant growth and development session. Last month, we did seed starting. The program meets on the first Saturday of every month, and the kids don't have to commit to all of the sessions, but it is really wonderful, and all of the kids here came to our first session. So that's really fun to see them, to get to see the plants, like, you know, the seeds that they planted last month and seeing them sprouting. And now today they're going to get to go into the garden, the Tustin Heritage Community Garden, and plant in the library's plot. So that's going to be really exciting.
Coming to life over here.
Like
you've got
soil.
Your...
Beautiful.
Wow. All right, want to try to find our root? Where's our root?
So we've got the flower. Yeah. Where's the flower?
I think that's the root.
I want to get dirty.
Great. All right. Look at all these works of art. All right. Can everybody rejoin their groups? Make sure you're with your group. And can we hold up our posters? I want to see our posters. And each group at a time, we're going to go over the parts of your plant and what plant you think it is.
We think it's peas because these tiny things on top are pink pods.
Yeah, the snow pea.
Who wants to be next?
We have tomato.
The tomato itself is... It's the fruit. The fruit right here. You want to put it right up here so we can see?
And that group had a special thing because they had an actual tomato plant to look at while you were assembling your poster, right? So you could refer to the actual tomato seedling. Pretty cool. Okay, last group.
Cabbage. What do you call
it? Cabbage cousin. Hi. Its cabbage cousin is
kale.
Kale.
Very
you.
Good.
All right, let's see. This one was a tricky one, right, guys? Because the kale doesn't have a fruit on the plant. It just has this part, the root. It has the stem. And then it has the
leaves.
Yeah.
So you guys had a trick question. Did you catch that? That your kale plant doesn't actually have a fruit. It has just the leaves and the stem and the root. So, that way.
All right, good work. We did awesome. I'm so proud of you. We're going to put the glue sticks in the red container. We're not going to throw anything. We're going to carefully place our markers back in the box. And we want to make sure that our area is nice and clean, okay? We're going to go out and start planting our plants in the garden, okay?
Yep.
Take 5 minutes for some water, go to the bathroom, and then meet back here. All right, can everybody rejoin their groups? Make sure you're with your group.
The Junior Master Gardeners are on their way inside the Tustin Heritage Community Garden.
All right, everybody, you can set your trees down. Eyes on me, okay? I'm going to show you something, and I'm going to give you a special tool. So with this little pry bar, we call it, you're going to dig underneath and just gently pry it out of the cell so that we have all part. If you have a small tray with little cells, you can use this method. If you have a big pot, then you can tip the plant upside down, actually.
I got it. I got the plant.
Yep, you just catch
it. I got the plant.
Good job.
I did it.
Okay, so if you have a plant in your hand, a big one, you're going to need a tool, like a shovel.
I need a shovel.
You need a shovel.
Where's our bucket?
Look, we've got some worms.
Worms.
This one is always sticking up.
Those are good. Those are good. Emily, we want to leave those in there. They're really helpful.
Has a big plant.
Oh, hi, worm. Yeah.
Hey, I need it.
Okay, you're going to want to dig a hole deep enough.
Yep. We'll share all of the tools because we don't have one for everybody.
But, yeah, we just want to make sure it's not too deep so that
I need a shovel.
Make a nice long row so that you can plant some of your scallions.
Okay, we're ready for you. We're ready. This? Over here.
I found a water.
This plant.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'm Adrienne Pachano, a.k.a. the Dirt Diva, and I am here with the Junior Master Gardeners as a collaborator with Callison Stratton, the Youth Programs Coordinator at the Tustin Coshecton branch of the Western Sullivan Public Library. Callison and I are doing a series this spring, summer, and fall for local kids to be able to take part in this national program. It's 8 classes long. We meet once a month at the Tustin branch, which has its own community garden attached to it. So we're very fortunate that we have that resource, as well as the Seed Library, which is part of this branch of the Western Sullivan Public Library system. And basically, if they complete all 8 classes, they get certified as a Junior Master Gardener. So it teaches them a little bit about botany, horticulture, community gardening, plant biology, all of the like things that the Master Gardeners as adults learn, but on a scaled-down version for kids. And I love working with this group because their enthusiasm for like just being raw, like excited about being in the dirt, reminds me of when I was that age and is why I decided to go into gardening as a profession, because I've always had passion for working with plants in particular, and it's just really cool to see kids light up when you take them outside and just show them a bed full of soil that has nothing in it, and they figure out what to do. And so Callison and I are just here to kind of steer their attention and focus and then teach them a little bit of background behind what they're doing. So today, our lesson was plant growth and development, and each month is a different topic.
You're going to make a furrow that goes from here all the way to here. We're going to make a line. We're going to make a line in the soil. Perfect. Amazing. I better go get the seeds. All right, who's ready to plant some seeds? Some peas? All right, let's do that next. Awesome.
Can you give me some?
That's pretty crazy.
Can I plant some seed too?
Hands out. Yay. Hands out. Hands out. Hands out. Now we're going to put these peas in the furrow that you just made, in the line.
What do you remember from today? What stood out from today?
We went outside and planted seeds.
All right, if you've got your sticker and you've written in your note, your journal, you and you've got your posters, you are free to go, my friends. But we will see you next month.
Thank you all.
Thank you, guys. All right, and give me your name tags. Give me your name tags. We're going to keep them. We're going to keep them here.
That's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeffersonville Bake Shop, open every day of the week for breakfast, lunch, and after-school snacks. Also featuring olive oil, ceramics, and other handmade items by artists and makers in Palestine.
On the next Fresh Air, we feature our interview about the life and legacy of Sly Stone. Questlove talks about his documentary Sly Lives, a.k.a. The Burden of Black Genius, on Hulu. Questlove won the Oscar for another of his music documentaries, Summer of Soul. Join us.
Listen to Fresh Air today at 2 on Radio Catskill.
The Daily draws on the unrivaled quality and expertise of the New York Times Global Newsroom. Our mission is to tell stories more deeply and to incorporate a new kind of transparency. Weekday evenings at 6:30 here on Radio Catskill.
Hi, I'm CoStar Grace KG, host of the Music Emporium. 2 hours of great music right here on Radio Catskill. Sometimes I start out with a little bit of talk concerning things in the world for the week. Then I jump into some tunes that you will enjoy. Jazz, funk, blues, and more. So come and hang out with me The Music Emporium, Tuesday night, 7 to 9, right here on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, this is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.